Today's episode is with two of our compost pioneers, Carl Hammer from Vermont Compost and Mike Murner from Earth Care Farm. They share advice, stories from the early days, wishes for the future, and so much more. Both of these wonderful humans have always been generous talking about their experiences and helping the compost industry grow. It seems fitting, as we head into the season of gratitude, to tap into these two dedicated composters. As an aside, I'm super blessed to also have Mike Murner as my dad. Thanks, Dad. I'm very proud to follow in your big old footsteps. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for compost lovers. Gravity rings around Saturn and Mike. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing quality compost. We're going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. This episode of The Composter is brought to you by Viably. As the master distributor of ComTech products in North America, Viably helps their customers to uncover the most forward-thinking solutions in the waste and recycling industry, including the proven four-step ComTech compost process of shred, turn, screen, and separate, which produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. Viably is also the distributor of the Turbo Separator Food Waste Depackaging System and the Harp Renewables Biodigester. Both of these revolutionary machines can help composters incorporate food scraps into their compost process, creating a more nutritious end product and the opportunity for an enhanced bottom line. You can learn more about Viably and their portfolio of compost solutions at thinkviably.com. While there, request a complimentary consultative meeting to discover how Viably can help your compost operation deliver what is possible. When it comes to buying a truck, you don't look for parts and try to build it yourself. You want something ready to ride. So why settle for parts when it comes to your farm management? In a world filled with parts vendors, Farmhand is the only all-in-one virtual assistant built by and for farmers. With one single platform, Farmhand enables you to offload your administrative tasks, send and manage communications, and sell more to your customers. The best part? Farmhand's ready-to-ride platform comes with zero startup costs or long-term commitments. Ready to earn more and work less? Take Farmhand's ready-to-ride solutions for a spin. Learn more and book a free test drive at farmhand.partners/no-till. That's farmhand.partners/no-till. Enjoy the show. Welcome to The Composter. We have Mike Murner and Carl Hammer, the two pioneers in the compost industry, on with us today. I'm so happy to have you both on here. And I'm sitting next to Mike Murner, who's also my dad, and I'm talking on the phone with Carl Hammer. So hopefully this week we hear each other well. I have so much I want to hear from both of you. Carl, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to ask you both this question, but I'm just going to start with you because I want you to share some advice of words of wisdom for all the young composters starting out. I'm just about to go to the Community Composting Forum in Cleveland, where there's so many young, super enthusiastic composters.
Thank you for the kind introduction. Advice to young composters. Keep it clean is the hard part. Compost, the plastics that are encroaching everywhere, very, very hard to keep it clean. And a lot of pressure to accept pollution in compost, but it's, I think of composters as the gatekeepers to the soil, and it's our job as stewardship to be discerning about pollution.
I think that's amazing advice. Dad, do you want to share?
Sure. I would say read to get the basic understanding of the principles within compost and read good books. It used to be Rodale Organic Gardening, Sir Albert Howard, and Biodynamics by Steiner. But now you have Rob Rink had a handbook out, which was excellent. So I would say read as much as you can. Don't believe everything you read, but if you got good, solid people, like I just mentioned, you can trust that they have a lot of insight into the principles of it. I would say learn by doing, experiment. There's no one and only way. I would highly recommend watching the movie Kiss the Ground. That movie will help you see the real value in what we're doing. And I would also say visit sites. Go to other compost sites and see how they're doing it. And just like Carl said, ask them how they're keeping the litter out of it. That's very important. And Carl, I want to mention, I love your logo slogan, Feed the Soil. That's what this is all about, feeding the soil. And there's corporate places that drive me nuts, like Scott's on TV that says, feed your lawn. They're bypassing something that's very important. Feed the soil, Carl's logo really sums it up for me.
Which I will say, I borrowed unembarrassedly from Sir Albert Howard, who said, feed the soil and let the soil feed the plants. The thing that he said that was Carl learned to that was that nature never farms without animals.
Yeah. Dad, I'm going to start this one with you. What are your one or two of your most formative, memorable cosmic compost experiences?
Well, I think everybody gets the benefit of some aha moments in their life. And early in my gardening experience, and this was after studying 4 years of chemical intensive agriculture, and being very confused about all the information that I had studied, I had this aha moment in the garden, just working in the garden. I don't know where this information comes from, but it was sort of just what Carl said about Sir Albert Howard. These thoughts are in our subconscious somehow. I had this thought that all we need is healthy soil to get healthy plants for healthy people and a healthy planet. And it was all about the health of the soil and not about everything I had learned in college and universities about chemical intensive agriculture. So that was an aha moment.
Well, you were in the home garden, Dad?
In the home garden.
What was the feeling like?
It was sort of like an out of body experience. It's like you're getting information from a collective consciousness, and it was beyond what I had tried to understand by studying agriculture. So, yeah, there was a little, you know, there's information and there's knowing and then there's wisdom. And so that was my aha moment, which led me to have the energy to really go ahead and create the business. And it says, it says two of your most formative. The other time, one time I was daydreaming in driving the payload or turning compost, just in a daydream, because it's, you become like a robot sometimes when you drive the payloader for hours and hours and hours. And, I just realized the compost process is without beginning or end. And, that was very relaxing to realize that something is without beginning or end. It's just always happening. So those are my two, it says, cosmic experiences. I would like to have more of them, but they're rare, but they're very enjoyable.
Yeah, well, I think I'll start with, I'll be chronological. I'm quite young when I first became very enamored of the experience of loading cow manure into a manure spreader. It was probably, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old, and it was my family didn't sure was so the bedding on that farm was hay in the gutter and some hardwood sawdust, but and all of that got wheeled out of the barn on wheelbarrows up plank, kind of pile that ascended from the barn, and was quite when you, so in the spring when you'd be breaking it out and putting it in the spreader, it would be quite green and grassy and well, it was lacto fermented, so which in a oxygen restricted an anoxic pile, and you'd load the spreader with it, and by the time you got to the field and were spreading, the green had turned brown because of the oxygen. It was a big revolution happening in the material. The whole, it was going from anoxic to fully oxygenated, and everybody's life was disrupted and changing, and new orders of regimes were occurring. And anyway, so that was sort of, and I loved everything about the smell of that change. Hmm. It was really a very olfactory for me, the allure of it. So that would be early. Later, well, I also spent a lot of time watching material fall out of a bucket in front of me and in a pile, and I always, at some point, I became very interested in knowing where I was in the pile, and that feeling that comes over you if you've turned a pile a few times as it evolves, and I think of it as becoming, a pile becomes an organism, separate, it has a skin, and being aware I've been here before, it became a thing I'd ask somebody I might be training, say, have you been everywhere in the pile? Have you seen everywhere in that pile? You should know, at a certain point in that meditation, you will become aware of the geography of the pile itself. For me, that also very, when you get in that groove and you're really with it, the pile, and you're seeing it and you're feeling it, it's a very, it's hard to say what, I mean, it's like anything else where you're relaxed, you're doing it right, your concentration is full, you're one with the world.
I feel like that feeds in, Carl, to the question of what social aspects of composting need more attention. Maybe that's one and the same.
We now live in a society where a scant 1% of the labor force is engaged in direct solar harvest for sustenance. And I think that's really a distorted way to utilize our work. I think we really need to aspire that, what's a reasonable ask? Let's say 15% of the labor force be directly involved in sustenance production from sunshine, and that includes making compost. Most peoples in our history have most of the labor has been about procuring sustenance directly from solar input. India is still more than half, significantly more than half on small holdings. Part of the catastrophe of that distribution of effort in our time and place is the lack of understanding, visceral knowing, hands-on understanding of those processes. And the town I'm in, we're sitting right now, East Montpelier, as recently as 1940, the brink of 1939 or 40, 200 farms, 200 families shipped milk in cans. It's now two farms in this town shipping milk. And so if you think about the collective knowledge represented at town meeting, it's a very different scene in terms of what people know. And just driving by a cornfield is really different from working a farm in terms of what you understand. So, I recognize that sounds improbable, but 15% would be every seventh household working to feed the other. everybody's doing is so much more important than farming. And I will add another little thing, that compost is not about adding carbon to soil. Yes, it is. There is carbon you're adding to soil, but compost needs to be understood as a catalyst for improving photosynthesis, which is how you draw down CO2 into stable soil carbon.
What about you, Dad? What social aspects of composting need more attention?
I think education of especially young children. The children get conditioned to put food scraps in the trash, which is ludicrous. Fortunately, we have a lot of colleges these days that are having degrees in sustainability and environmental studies and ecology. And I think there'll be a tremendous amount of people that could help educate young children and start source separating right from schools. And then the kids could bring it home to their parents. The children could teach their parents. And the other social aspect is we just have so much damn litter in the world. We get the food scraps and there'll be stickers on the bananas and the apples. And we got to get away from the excessive amount of plastics. So education of young children to get them to start to, so we get to a goal of, like Carl was mentioning there, respecting the life in the soil. By making compost, you're spreading a life force, and the children need to be kind of guided in that way. So that's the two social aspects, education and litter.
It sounds like both of you are saying boils down to connecting humans with the land and getting us back to that place where we're involved with the processes and how it feeds us and how we feed it. So that's beautiful. Any technical aspects of composting that need more attention from people? Dad, I'll start with you since you're on that.
All right. The technical aspects, I would say, people need to pay more attention to the CN ratio, just with a basic little studying of that, because we're having more and more food scraps available, but there's plenty of carbonaceous materials in our bioregions, but they just need, so they don't have that odor event with too much putrescibles. So paying attention to the CN ratio, and then just an awareness of not having negative thoughts about compost, understanding there are persistent herbicides and PFAS, and doing everything in your power to avoid them from coming to your site, the persistent herbicides and the PFAS. It takes a lot of questioning, and sometimes it's very hard to determine when you're taking in manure and beddings, where that hay came from. And persistence is a relative term, but it's just terrible when somebody goes to the trouble of making a good quality compost and then they find out there was herbicides in it that are phytotoxic. So I would say the techno aspects of that, paying attention, more awareness about the problematic things and avoiding them and hoping our society gets to banning them.
I've been finding that society is getting more and more confused, thinking that compost is just food scraps.
Right.
That's almost the way the towns are talking about it. And it is confusing. People think that what they gather from their kitchen is compost.
Distinction between compost and compostables. Compost, you know, comes from a Latin root about mixing and combining. So it is, that's helpful to remember, I think. And technically, to the persistent herbicide, composters should generally undertake a plant bioassay of their products to protect their customers and themselves from herbicide damage. And those bioassays should be enough different cultivars. They should include can provide phytotoxic symptoms similar to herbicide.
Did you want to add anything else about technical aspects, Carl?
Yeah. I think it's useful to understand that aerobic and anaerobic, those are spectrums, so that there are opportunities to manage material, particularly the storage and handling of materials that you're going to compost thermophilically in somewhat oxygen or air restricted ways, anoxic pickling, if you will. Because we are feeding poultry before we go into our thermophilic compost making, we want to retain protein in the matrix and restricting oxygen. And so as we get manures, we're kind of like silage piles that pickle. We're into pickling. So once thermophilic activity starts, the food availability for poultry is rapidly diminished. And so chickens thrive on that first phasing of what we call the pickle. Anaerobic, aerobic is not binary, and it's not yes, no. It is always going to be variation within the aggregates in any, even a very aerobic mix will have larger aggregates with anoxic content, and that's not a bad thing. So anaerobic is not evil. I mean, anaerobic can cause a lot of trouble and cytotoxic trouble, but you need a little sort of broader thinking about that, the supply of air.
Okay, Dad, I'm going to start this one with you. Is there one batch of compost that stands out in your memory?
Before we had all this wonderful equipment, we started just with a farm tractor that had like a 1 cubic yard bucket on it. It was not an attachment. It was an integrated bucket. And we had a windrow system. Heinz Grotzi from the Meadowbrook Herb Garden was one of my mentors that showed me how to do a windrow system, was just with a farm tractor, and that's how we started. But what was the most memorable thing to me was, back then we didn't have a screener. I bought a golf course would use, the top dressing machine, where you shovel by hand. Two people could shovel onto a conveyor belt, and it just drove it up and kind of screened it by shredding it a little bit. And but what I remember was doing it by hand was so enjoyable when you're young and fit, that the product looked beautiful. It was so, so beautiful, the end product. It was just a thing of beauty. And it got into my bones how gorgeous soil is, and how we just take a lot of people in our society take it for granted, but some people just once you have that feeling, you can't waste any organic matter that's compostable. You want to see more and more materials returned to the earth in a positive way.
Carl, same question for you. Is there one batch of compost that stands out in your memory?
I don't know. I would say compost wants to happen, and it's a very forgiving process. It's really, unless there's some really devastating bad actor in your ingredients, you will have useful material at the end, no matter how perfectly or imperfectly manage it. A batch that stands out in my mind. I guess I will say also that sometimes you get a pile that just won't do what you expected it to do. We know that, you know, somebody won't get hot, and they have to go around again. And the good news is there's no loss in that sense. We just bring it all around and do it again if we need to use it as an ingredient. material, sort of, we think of it as a as tuition for the process. And then there's the specificity of sight. We at a certain point had about five sites operating in different parts of the state, and a lot of that material came to Montpelier for blending and potting soil making. And even though there was some intention to have the supplies be very consistent across sites, I could always personally tell which site a compost was from just by looking at it and smelling it. I guess I avoided the question pretty much. I can't remember a particular. Close my eyes and try to see a pile. When my now 30-ish year, 31-year-old son was two, I can remember a pile that I was turning by hand in a garden in the home farm in Berkshire that with him. And I was doing a process where you turn the pile a little down the hill and make a slot through it, and then fill that slot, and that makes it the next slot. And this was trying to be maximally efficient with hand tools to get the job done. And he was taking in what a 1.5-year-old might be taking in. So yeah, when I closed my eyes, that was.
I'm going to add to this one too, because I grew up in the middle of this industrial sized compost operation, on our family farm. But it wasn't until I was maybe 12 or 13 that really struck me. We had a home compost pile. And at that point, my brother was doing a biodynamic training with Heinz Grotzky. And suddenly the pile in the home garden got very, perfectly rectangular with these beautiful walls. And we started adding the layers of comfrey and nettles and horsetails in between, like treating it with herbs. And I started to see compost even in a higher light at that point of my life as an early teenager. And that kind of reverence and thinking of it more of a medicinal property to bring back to the earth really kind of hit me. So that was that pile, I think. And then seeing that you were actually doing that at a large scale too, but it didn't hit me until I saw it in the home garden.
I think about, I have now a grandson who's just two. And I think about, and he's infatuated with loaders and heavy equipment. And we also have, donkeys on the farm, but he sees the vast array of heavy equipment. And I think about what a terrible example we're setting in certain ways. And I guess, yeah, make some compost by hand would be a good example to set. It's been a while since I did that, I have to admit. Heinz wrote a great book, the little greenhouses. I think he called it Biodynamic Greenhouse Production or something like that. Yeah. You must have read that, Prince's book. And he has a beautiful section on fresh crushed stone, square shouldered stones, sands. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I made compost for Meadowbrook way back.
Oh, wow.
When I was in New York. Heinz really believed in composting each ingredient separately.
Yeah, yeah.
And then combining them, which is an interesting take.
I'll add too, as a 16-year-old son who's also grown up here with all the big equipment. There's a beauty in that too. He's in school now, and he can like fix anything, and he understands how things work. And I like you're saying, Carl, it's my job to keep introducing him, keep showing him the simpler side too of the hand turning and the growing in the garden. So yeah, keeping the both.
Lately had a change of fuel in April. Since 2006, we've run every machine on the place in season on biodiesel.
Mm.
And we put a lot of effort into getting plant-based, non-toxic, all the fluids, the hydraulic fluids, we use food machine greases, all those things we accomplished. But for about 10 years, I've been aware that there is another process, fuel process, instead of biodiesel, which is a fatty acid methyl esterization, there's a hydrogenation process, which produces what's called renewable diesel, or RD. And it's only been available basically in California for the last 8 to 10 years. But April, we started getting renewable diesel. The big benefit of renewable diesel, it takes the same feedstocks that you would make biodiesel from, but it makes them into a product that has comparable or even better cold flow behavior, cold weather behavior than petroleum diesel. So we've now finally been able to achieve using no petroleum for fuel in our process, even in the winter.
Wow.
And that was, and in that sense, we would go back to the appropriateness of these heavy, the heavy equipment. We really tried to gentle those beasts, you know, to say we used the devil's tools, but we really put them to a different purpose.
Join me and composters from around the country at Compost 2025 in Phoenix, Arizona, January 27th to the 30th, where industry leaders gather to revolutionize composting. Don't miss keynote speaker Stephanie Katsaros, president of Brightbeat, a Chicago-based organization sharing insights on advancing environmental stewardship and social change. Network with professionals, attend workshops, and explore the latest innovations in composting. Register now at compostconference.com and use coupon code NOTILL for 10% off. See you there. Oh yeah, it's seed browsing season, and High Mowing Organic Seeds is releasing 66 new seed varieties for 2025 on November 1st. These beautiful and productive vegetable, flower, and herb varieties are 100% organic and non-GMO and trialed for optimal performance in organic growing systems. Whether you're trying to bring your best to your CSA, wholesale customers, or to the farmer's market, High Mowing has the professional quality seeds and supportive grower reps to get you from seed to harvest. Visit highmowingseeds.com to request a catalog and use NOTILL25, all caps, for 10% off your order of $100 or more. And now back to the show. Dad, I'm going to ask you this one. So recently we bought land, new land, and a lot of people listening are just starting out and either trying to site a place or maybe just bought land to start their compost operations, or they're a farm looking for a place to start their compost operation on their farm. Can you share what we saw in the property that let you know it would be good for making compost?
I think it was the perfect place. It was two abandoned gravel banks. And with that gravel base, it's so simple just to go in there and have a platform to make the compost on. It's very rural. It's basically all farms around it. And it's been a mine. It's abused land that we can feel good about regenerating. In our compost process, when we screen, we have these overs, the larger wood chips, or in our bioregion, we have shellfish or the larger shells. And there's a tremendous amount of good compost stuck to those wood chips that didn't break down in 1 year. And with those overs, that what we call tailings, we can revegetate this site. And Jane found the site. It's 241 acres, and it's been abused, and it would just feel so good to spread those overs and regenerate areas while we're making the compost and selling the screen compost. So it's and it's difficult. I've known a lot of young people that wanted to find sites to make compost, and there's a little bit of a problem of not in my backyard type of thing, where the earth needs it desperately at this point right now. But this site is, to me, this site is ideal. It's so I'm very happy and relieved that Jane found this site, and there's a possibility of making a lot more compost in our little farm.
One thing I was really paying attention to was the wind direction there, the prevailing wind direction. And it just very fortunately, just like you kind of accidentally found that here, Dad, the prevailing wind direction on our farm, current farm, goes into this 1,000 acres of great swamp. And so occasionally when we have those odors, they do go into there, and there's the deer don't seem to complain.
Yeah, that was just luck, because I didn't plan that when I bought the farm, but the prevailing wind is from the southwest, and we have next to us another 100-acre farm and 100 acres of nature conservancy, and then the great swamp of thousands of acres. So nobody's complaining.
You know, and there's always ways around it. There's those complicated ASP systems that can capture the air and filter it. And you can, there's ways around it if you're in a populated area, which makes sense to have compost in those too. But it was great here to not have it blowing into the neighbors. And same thing at the new sites, blowing into the forest. So
when I heard about your new site, it sounded, that 30-acre sandbox sounded like a lot of fun. 200 some odd acres of other land. By contrast, we our main site is on Main Street in the city of Montpelier, and there's an 85 or so home development that abuts us. And it's downhill from us. So, you know, on July 4th, you get kind of a heat inversion afternoon when everybody's grilling. The air comes flowing gently down the ridge from our piles to the neighbors' barbecues. And so we are very odor vigilant. And that's required us to manage, well, no puddles. We don't tolerate puddles on the farm. And we cap process kind of religiously with a blend of overs. All, you know, we return all our overs to the process in the form of cap, which is a blend of compost. We use high carbon top ash from a wood-fired power plant in that mix, and hardwood bark is in our capping material. And we have to manage. I mean, it'd be easy to cap everything thick enough so there'd never be a malodor, but we also are trying to feed poultry, and they don't eat the cap. So if we put too much cap on, they can't get to the food readily. So it's a funny balance to be struck. I think our site would be a good example of one that people should, probably wouldn't recommend. It wouldn't be on anybody's list of conditions for a site that you would buy for a compost facility. Grades were steep. A lot of it was shallow to bedrock. Its main asset, if it is one, is that it's in the city on Main Street, which means that we have access to a lot of food scraps and wood waste and so on. And we also have access to a lot of animal manure, because the farms in our neighborhood are big and have access.
Yeah, it's that trade-off of proximity to the materials versus proximity to neighbors. And yeah, it takes really good management.
I did buy another piece of land a couple of miles further out. It was also an opportunity that on a piece of land that had been abused, has been abused, and was once a quite beautiful grass farm, but that has spent 40 or so years as a Christmas tree farm, which kind of got away from them. They didn't sell the market. They didn't really have a market plan. They planted 100 some odd acres of trees, and when they started to get bigger than they could readily be sold as Christmas trees, I'm not sure it would be qualified as ideal either, but we intend to perimeter fence it and make silver pasture out of it for cattle and do some composting on that land.
Great. I would love
to. I had to say I was jealous when I looked at the specs on what you, you know, I thought, oh, that'd be fun to find the thing you just bought.
I was almost going to rent 11 acres from somebody that was not going to be ideal. And then it's actually somebody on my crew, this guy, Justin, was the one who said, why don't we just look over the line in Connecticut? There's a great town that's really rural. And we looked and this was available. It felt like just serendipitous. Amazing.
What does a fulfilled vision of food circularity look like to me? When I talk to, I get a certain amount of, sustainability farming. You know, we have Sterling College. I get some college tours of our facility. And now from my age of 72, I often ask the 20-year-olds, you know, 19 and 20-year-olds, to think about what they would like to, you know, when they've done 40 years of effort about these issues, what's the world they'd like to see? What are they hoping to achieve as a generation doing this work? What do we hope the world looks like as we? I think of our project and projects like ours as mitigation of industrial culture. And what are we hoping, you know, when we use our overs, when we build terraces, when we farm land, I'm hoping to improve the photosynthetic opportunity for the community beyond. And hope that we will learn how to step down from our calorie imbalance, where we burn more calories to produce a calorie food than it's that calorie imbalance. So again, it's back to that social question. I hope that we will reestablish the value of doing the work and have more of the community doing it. And, you know, if every seventh household kept 350 to 400 birds, chickens of all ages, we could let the 300 million birds in cages out of their cages. We wouldn't need broilers. There would be no poultry industry if every seventh house kept 400 birds, and there would no longer be wasted food either. And so is 15% of the labor force doing this work spread out over all the communities so that we would have this healthy solar receiving fabric that fed everybody, which is what peasant agriculture has historically been. And how could we integrate that into our modernist condition without actually necessarily going to Mars? We have all the tools and knowledge. We've done it well over and over again. We have and we've ruined it over and over again. Those markers are there. If you look at the Andes, for instance, and Machu Picchu and Ayantatambo and those places, people reorganized that landscape. It required hundreds of years of a shared landscape vision to achieve the work that they did. We don't even know technically how they did some of the work. And people there, the descendants of those people, laugh when asked about who did this. They think, you don't think people did this. This was obviously gods that straightened the Urubamba River mile at a time and made thousands of hectares of engineered soil 12 feet deep. So people have done all these things and ruined all these things, and we know about all that.
Dad, I'm going to ask you the same question. What does a fulfilled vision of food circularity look like to you? And I'm going to thank Nathan from Rust Belt Riders for this question, actually.
Well, I've read there's no waste in nature. To keep it circular, we just need a consciousness of recycling all our food scraps. And it's necessary for the future health of future generations to have this good soil. If we deplete our soil, we're kind of slowly committing suicide. So for future generations, just like the indigenous people always thought about, we need to realize there's no waste in nature. And the only waste is when we're unconscious about the need to keep it healthy. So it's just a consciousness that I think is definitely growing, and more and more people are aware of it. So no waste.
Yes. Anything else you want to add or let people know, Dad?
Well, I want to congratulate Carl when he said he went to biodiesel, and not only in the fuel, but in his oils. That's a major, major accomplishment. I mean, that's something to work towards. One time I bought a payloader, and we were using biodiesel, and they said they would not warranty the payloader if I used biodiesel. And I said, then I'm not buying it. Next week, they call me up and says, we can warranty the payloader if you use biodiesel.
We have a leaf truck from Penske that we're fueling on this tree. In part, you know, we didn't put biodiesel in it. It was the one exception in our fleet. And then along came the renewable diesel. And I decided, I thought, well, we could be fueling this truck with the RD, and, you know, we probably shouldn't ask Penske, but I thought, all right, you know what, I'm going to ask him, right? And Penske's a big battleship, takes time, but after about a month of repeatedly finding the right person to talk to, they came back with a ringing endorsement of renewable diesel. They have a lot of experience with it in California because there's a 15% taxing incentive, which is why we were unable to get renewable diesel for a long time on the East Coast, because it was all, the whole capacity was going to California. But yeah, Penske not only endorsed us using the renewable diesel in that truck, but also in the specific manufacturer, Neste, who was a Finnish company that that pioneered the hydrogenation process. Though now, I mean, Valero, I was first aware of it because Valero, apparently renewable diesel is readily produced in gasoline refineries. You can retrofit them cost-effectively, and Valero had renovated two gasoline refineries in Louisiana to make renewable diesel for the California market, which put a giant sucking sound on the feedstocks for biodiesel at the time. This is 8 years ago or so, when Valero started really drawing down the used oil markets and so on, and that actually pushed up the pricing on biodiesel for us at the time. I think RD is also the process that aviation, bioaviation fuels are utilizing. So it's I don't know what it's going to do to the biodiesel manufacturers. We have some seriously good biodiesel manufacturers. You do in Rhode Island, and we have in New Hampshire here. And I'm going to assume that they're going to be under some pressure to change process. It's kind of a lot easier to run biofuels, and I think all of the manufacturers are going to come around to providing warranty. We've now, because of our biodiesel use and because of the challenges with the Tier 4 engines and their sensors that don't like biodiesel and the warranty issues, we're now running a pretty antique roadshow here with a lot of mechanical fuel injection, and that we just don't even suffer what people with new engines suffer quite a lot about the, and we're not producing the volumes that a lot of that emission control was put in place to manage petroleum. So I don't know. We're kind of wondering if we can wait it out until we go full electric on everything.
And is that like antiques, like prior to what time, like 2000?
Depends on the manufacturer, but 2005 or 6, a lot of early 2000s. And, it's a question. We solve the problem about availability by having extras, and we fix them. And we have enough extras so that we can tolerate having something out of service for weeks. Because in terms of the business part of what we do, people are the single most expensive part. So if you've got a butt, you definitely want a working seat for each butt. And so we can't tolerate not having an available loader on any given day. But so we have enough loaders that we can have a couple of them laid up for periods of time without not having the availability. And that would be harder to do with new machinery, actually. And new machinery does break.
It does. Yeah, we try to have two of everything here just for that reason. Great. Well, I want to thank you both so much. You've done so much for the industry and it made things so much easier for my generation for composting. And it's just this information is so valuable. And I know I'm thanking you and so is hundreds and hundreds of younger composters. So thank you for sharing your information so generously, always, both of you. So thank you so much.
We didn't even get into regulatory, which is probably good because that could be a conversation.
I started before there were regulations. But now, let's not go down that road.
We ended up with a compost facility close enough to our state house so that we could almost build a catapult and get donkey turds to hit the golden dome. And it's been convenient because I've spent a lot of time in that state house working on legislation because our enterprise seemed to always fall in regulatory cracks one way or another between the agricultural and the waste management regulations in Vermont. That can get expensive.
It sure can. Yeah. Well, thanks for all that work. There's so much behind the scenes work besides making compost. My dad and I were just talking that there's so much less time that I'm making compost and so much more time that I'm at the state house and going to meetings and podcasts and things. I never would have expected this, but I'm glad I have 20 years of making compost and farming before this. And you guys have 40. So thank you so, so much. I appreciate you both so much. And I'm sure I'll have you on the show again.
All right. Mike, a pleasure. Thank you.
Be well, Carl. Take care.
Thank you for all the insights, Carl and Mike. So much good compost experience. Check out Vermont Compost at vermontcompost.com and Earth Care Farm at earthcarefarm.com. We are already on the last episode of season 3. Wow, that escalated quickly. I've learned so much this 2024 season by talking to all of these composters of vastly different scales and techniques. I want to thank No-Till Growers for making this possible. All of our sponsors, the awesome music of Soul Shot, Mother Earth, Jah, Buddha, God, and all that allows for this fun career. And especially you, our compost-loving listeners.